Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Farrah Jasmine Griffin, author of In Search of a Beautiful Freedom, New and Selected Essays. She is a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies and English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. She is the author or editor of 9 books, including Read Until You Understand, The Profound Wisdom of Black Life in Literature. And my podcast interview with Farrah last year about Read Until You Understand was my most downloaded episode of 2022. So real excited to have you back on, Farrah, and welcome.
Thank you. That was one of my best interviews. I so enjoyed it. So I'm thrilled to be back.
When I saw that your book came out, and it was a sort of a collection of essays over 3 decades. You have 27 essays, I believe. When you were putting this collection together, did you have a theme already in mind and were looking for essays from the past that would fit the theme? Or was it that you were going through all these essays? And I do need to add, you provided some new essays, I believe, for this book also. Or did you discover a theme as you perused all those essays from the past and the present?
Yeah, I think it was more the latter, more I kind of discovered a theme. Some of my students and I, actually, I should say some colleagues, old colleagues, friends, had been encouraging me to put together a collection because they teach some of them. And they were like, we just need them in one cover. We need them under one cover. And so some of my graduate students were collecting them for me and put them all together in a great big binder. And I started looking at a lot of the essays and discovered a kind of theme that came together as I started grouping them. Almost all of them sort of were informed by some aspect of Black feminism, although not all of them were about Black women. Per se. Many of them were, but not all of them. Almost many of them were about the arts. Some were about music, some were about literature, some were about reading, some were about crises. But I started seeing certain kinds of themes emerging. And I think the themes that were emerging were a kind of quest for freedom, an appreciation of what our artists and our thinkers have taught us and guided us along the way in that quest for freedom, and an appreciation for the beauty of Black life and experiences as we struggle. There's always beauty in that struggle. And so I think those were sort of the thematics that emerged as I was putting it together.
What makes writing an essay such a powerful statement?
Yeah, I think that that's a really wonderful way to put it. I think of the essay, particularly for African-American writers, it's something that African-American writers really have done tremendous things with the essay form. It's short. One can read them in one sitting. You can read an essay in one sitting. You can say what you have to say. You can build an argument. You can persuade something. It can be persuasive. It can almost be a sermon in some instances, which is powerful in that way. It draws out of our oral tradition. But for me, I think it's powerful because it's an invitation to think along with the writer. You know, the writer is trying to think through something. And as you're reading along with them, you're thinking through it with them. You can kind of see them think through a knotty subject and try to come up with a way through that project. And I think that that process, that invitation to engage in the process of thinking with someone else in community is very powerful. I think it's very powerful. And it's open-ended. You continue to think long after you finish reading it. It's not like you're done. It's ongoing.
You made me think a lot with some of the essays you wrote. I'm a little bit of a jazz fan, and I say a little bit because I've gone back and forth on listening to it a lot and not listening to it a lot. And the first thing that struck me was your essay, "It Takes Two People to Confirm the Truth of Jazz Fiction," of Shirley Ann Williams and Tony K. Bambara. Mm-hmm. And what struck me was you've given us a different lens to look at jazz fiction from, not just with the protagonist being an actual male jazz musician, but in a case of Martha being the lover of a jazz musician named Time. And I love the way, and this was Shirley Ann Williams' first published story, but it sounded so familiar to me, the way her mother advised her against the jazz musician. I grew up in New Orleans, and I can recall those kind of conversations parents would have with their daughters about, this is not the right guy for you. This is a bad guy for you. This musician is not. Now, of course, I also spent a little time in high school with Marcellus. So there were some jazz musicians that actually made a good living. But talk about this Shirley Ann Williams, giving us a different perspective of the jazz musician from the perspective of the jazz musician's lover.
Yeah, no, I love that story. I read that story when I was a girl, actually, and then went back to it once I became a literary critic. And I love it because Shirley Ann Williams, you know, she takes seriously our language and our mother-daughter conversations and makes them literary, you know, and reminds us that jazz musicians are part of a community. They aren't just these, you know, kind of lone geniuses, and not all of them are even geniuses, you know, they're brothers who are part of a community who have mothers and cousins and sisters and wives and girlfriends and all of that. And so she kind of steps back and says, let me look at some of the women who surround them before they become the kind of famous people who we revere, right? And she looks at this young woman who's falling in love with a jazz musician who doesn't necessarily have, you know, he wants to pursue his music and is not necessarily going to be the best husband or father for her child. And her mother wants her to have a stable life. And she's like, this is not what this man is going to provide for you. But there are other things that he might provide. You know, he provides a sense of pride in her beauty, her Black beauty, a different kind of aesthetic, things that she also needs. And I just love the way Shirley Ann Williams says, you know, let's look at the musician from the perspective of the women, the lovers, the mothers, those other people who also surround them, and how they're touched by who these musicians are as well.
Also think about Alice Coltrane and John Coltrane. And John Coltrane is, you know, when I look at my two favorite jazz albums of all time, if I was on a desert island, I would always have A Love Supreme. Yes. And the Miles Davis, I would blank on you right now, but the Miles Davis Kinda Blue.
Right.
Those are the two albums I would have with me on a desert island.
Good choices.
John Coltrane's wife, he replaced one of his pianists with Alice Coltrane. And people were very critical of that. But for him, for what he needed from a piano player, she was the right choice for him.
She was the right choice. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I hope that the essays here do is that they open up people a little more to Train, thinking about how Train made possible things for the jazz musician women. And the music he was hearing, Alice was playing. Alice could play. And, you know, he was even drawn to her because she played the harp, you know, and she could play things on the harp that he wanted to hear in his own music. And you can hear that she's a harpist when you hear her playing the piano. And for that stage in his development, that's what was happening for him. And even before he meets Alice, his wife, Naima, for whom he writes one of the most beautiful ballads in all of jazz music, Naima. Naima is the one who introduces him to Eastern spirituality and to Islam and to spiritualities outside of Christianity. And he attributes her with that. So, you know, the women, his cousin Alice, it's the women who he surrounds himself with who really help open him up and inspire him musically and spiritually. And they are in some ways responsible for the John Coltrane who we come to know and love.
You know, it's interesting because when I think about the tropes of the independent, successful person making it on his or her own with nobody helping them, and it's not true, actually. And even when I read the stories, I interview a lot of authors, and they'll talk about how their spouses are the first ones to read the book and give them feedback on it. Mm-hmm. And so how did we get to this point where there's this sort of this trope of he or she makes it on his or her own or their own with no support whatsoever, as opposed to the reality of the community part of making music?
Yeah, I think it's a very much a kind of Western mythology, you know, that goes against so many cultures that know that communities are important. Now, individuals, of course, are important. And what often happens is that, you know, there's an individual who has an extraordinary talent, but that the people around them recognize that talent and provide the support and the sustenance that they need in order to explore it and to achieve the talent, right? And so it's almost impossible to do it on your own, because you're not feeding yourself, you know, you're not housing yourself. It's when you no longer have to worry about those basic needs being met, when other people are also helping to meet those basic needs, then you can go on and explore, you know, where that talent leads you. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've always been interested in is, what are the mechanisms that make it possible for the creative genius to emerge? And also emerging in the context of other creative people. And so I'm also interested in those communities of creative people. And you see some of that happening in these essays as well.
Do you remember when you first began your love affair with jazz music? I remember in high school, a classmate of mine telling me about John Coltrane. I had no idea who John Coltrane was. Yeah. And she told me about his great saxophone playing and told me I really needed to check him out. And, you know, at that point in time, I was the Earth, Wind & Fire, Isley Brothers, you know, Led Zeppelin, the Eagles, right. Commodores kind of guy. Yes. And she's talking about this John Coltrane. I'm like, who is John Coltrane? So how did you discover your love of jazz?
So my love of jazz, I first came through my father. My father was a big jazz head. And so I listened to a lot of his records and listened with him. And then after he died, listened to his records. And so I sort of inherited a curiosity about jazz from him. And then through different people I met throughout my life who would turn me on to different artists and different kinds of jazz. And, you know, I was into a kind of straight ahead jazz, and somebody else would say, but you really need to listen to this avant-garde jazz, or you need to listen to this person, or like you, listen to this Coltrane. I had a great friend, Salim Washington, was like, you really need to listen to more Train, you know? And so that's what happened. And I think also a lot of people came to jazz through those great funk bands of the 70s, because, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, and those were serious musicians who also knew their jazz and had jazz chops. So, you know, you kind of come to the jazz musicians. Often a lot of people came to the jazz musicians through Earth, Wind & Fire. You know, they sort of set the groundwork for many of us as well, with an appreciation of their musicianship. So, but I do think it's often friends who will turn you on to different artists and really hip you to different albums, different musicians, different ways of hearing and ways of listening.
So when did you start writing about jazz? Because we have these sort of these narrow view of the literary critic, and we think the literary critic only writes about literature.
Yes, yes.
So open up my mind and everybody else's.
Yeah. So I think I'd always written a little bit about music. You know, even as a college student, I'd written a little about music. And then in my dissertation, I wrote primarily about literature. I wrote about migration, how African-American artists wrote about the Great Migration. And I included some stuff about music in there. So I included Stevie Wonder's Living for the City, for instance, in there, and said that was a migration narrative, just like the novels were a migration narrative. If you listen to the whole piece, it's a story about a young man who migrates, right? Both musically and the lyrics. And then I had a colleague who was a poet who read that book, it became my first book. And he said, I love the way you write about music. I wish you would write more about music. So I taught myself more about music. I played the flute as a girl, but I taught myself more about music. I hung out with a bunch of musicians and people who were trained musicologists, and they were very patient with me and they helped me learn. And then I started writing more about jazz. And my second book was on Billie Holiday. And so I think what they helped me learn is that I didn't limit myself. I wrote about the literary and I wrote about music, and I never pretended that I was writing about music as a musicologist, that I was writing about music as a cultural critic and as a cultural historian, but not someone who would write about it as someone who had been trained as a musicologist. But it just became yet another subject that I was very curious about and very interested in. And so you will find, you know, several essays about music in this collection.
I was reading also you wrote about John Panish, who compared the representation of jazz and jazz musicians by black and white writers in the 1950s and early 1960s. And he wrote that white writers tended to dehistoricize and decontextualize the development of music and emphasize competitive individualism over any sense of community. But Black writers wrote differently about these musicians.
Yeah, I think that's changed now because of what Black writers did, that Black writers insisted on writing about, you know, community, about family, about placing these musicians in context, and not about the kind of competitiveness, the battling it out night after night, you know, the fighting, the... and now I think that all of the writers who write about the music have learned so much about from the ways that Black writers wrote about them. You know, people tend to think of Ralph Ellison and Amiri Baraka, the two towering figures who wrote beautifully about the music and wrote about it very differently, you know, quite differently, often at odds with each other, and Albert Murray. But I think those of us who came after them learned so much from both of those gentlemen that we created a different way of thinking about and writing about the music, so that now it's impossible to write about musicians without writing about the context, the community, the histories that produce them.
It reminds me of a story I read in this great biography of Chester Himes, mm-hmm. about a holiday conflict between Ralph Ellison and Chester Himes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they almost got into a fist fight.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But you turned me on to a musician I wasn't really aware of when I was reading your essay, Lady Sing Miles.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge Miles Davis fan. I probably have more Miles Davis's albums than any other jazz music. Not probably. I do have more of his albums than anybody else. But he was also one of those figures that, as you write, I think, Davis as Prince of Darkness and Bearer of Light.
Yeah.
So first, let me get the Shirley Horn, because I went back and listened to some of that music of Shirley Horn on the I Remember Miles album. And you write that Miles was like an uncle to her. And I think a lot of people are familiar with the issues he had with, you know, violence against women.
That was very public.
And even throughout these days, we have the Chris Brown and Rihanna issue.
Yeah.
And it's just such a complicated way. How do you delve into a situation where someone's a clear musical genius, but also has aspects of them that are clearly abhorrent?
Yeah, no, I think that that's why Miles is a interesting case study in that way, you know. And he fascinates for that reason. There's a beautiful little new novella out by someone named Wesley Brown called Blue and Green. And it's a fiction inspired by Miles's life, the night that he was beaten by the police, right before he marries Frances Taylor, his wife, who he also was abusive. He abused. And a half of the novel is from Frances's perspective. And it's really worth reading, if only for that reason. And so I think that Miles is fascinating because he, you know, he was, interestingly enough, not just violent against women. He was violent against some of his bandmates. I mean, he was violent, and it seems like mostly violent when he was abusing drugs, less so when he was not. And, you know, produced some of the most important, most beautiful music we have. And I chose, instead of writing about him, who, you know, I wrote a book about Miles. I co-authored a book about Miles. But in this essay, instead of writing about Miles, I chose to write about the women who have played his music, have been used his music to express their own artistry. And Shirley Horn, who he mentored, he was a mentor to Shirley Horn. Shirley Horn was one of them, and Cassandra Wilson is the other one. So that was one of the things that ways that I decided to work through that, like, you know, not to revere the abuser, but to see what these women, these gifted women musicians, have done with that music.
I'm thinking also you reference this essay, Mad at Miles, where Pearl Cleage.
Cleage, yes.
Pearl Cleage writes, "We forget that the music, not the man, made this promise." Also talk about how he refused to let record labels put white women on his album covers.
Yes.
And he often insisted that his ladies of the moment, his black ladies, were on the cover of his albums when he had women on the cover of his albums.
Right. He actually had, there was one album where they, it was already out. It was out and had a white woman on a sailboat, and he made them change it. He made them change the cover. And usually it was, you know, there at least two or three covers that Francis is on the cover. Betty Mabry is on the cover. Betty Davis is on the cover of another one. Cicely Tyson is on the cover of another one. And so, you know, it complicates this, notion of that one can revere Black beauty and at the same time be abusive of Black women. I mean, there are all kinds of complicated issues that Miles raises for us.
Another complicated relationship, I think, is actually between Miles Davis and Wynton Marsalis.
Yes.
So Cassandra Wilson received a commission by Jazz at Lincoln and she chose to explore the work of Miles Davis, which is interesting because, of course, Wynton Marsalis has been leading the jazz orchestra at Lincoln for a very long time. Yes. And even I remember back in the day, his criticism of Miles Davis' experimentation with hip hop, rock, fusion, and smooth jazz. But also, I remember Miles's reaction being, "I played that."
Yes. Yes. That was Miles. Miles is like, "You got to keep moving forward. You got to keep moving forward," you know? And so he was constantly moving forward, although he's always himself. He's always recognizable. You know, the musical settings that he's playing in is different, you know? So we hear fusion, we can hear a little hard rock, we can hear all kinds of things, but he's always recognizable in that. He doesn't, you know, there are people who would have kept him in the kind of blue era forever. But he felt that that was stagnant, so he moved through it.
So let's talk about Toni Morrison. I think Toni Morrison might be your favorite writer.
One of them, certainly, by far.
Certainly
the most influential writer on me, yes.
And you wrote an essay called Wrestling Till Dawn on Becoming an Intellectual in the Age of Morrison, and you reference reading Sula.
Yes.
I believe after your father died.
Yeah, I read it a few years after he passed away. I was, you know, probably a young adolescent, 13, maybe. My dad died when I was 9. But I remember reading it again with a group of girls in my neighborhood. We were all reading it.
And you talk about how you could see many of the characters, or at least I see that you saw many of the characters of Sula were actually in your life. And it's always interesting when you read these novels and you start identifying with these characters in the novel, saying, "Yeah, that's so and so around the corner, and that's yeah. my auntie, and that's my grandma." Talk about that experience of reading a novel at 13 and saying, "This reminds me of my family and neighborhood."
Yeah, suddenly, like the people who were in the neighborhood, you know, like you begin to see them in more complicated ways, you know, like the neighborhood alcoholic, you know. Who everybody knows is struggling, right? All of a sudden you think, oh, he's sort of like this person in a Toni Morrison novel. And so maybe he's actually more intriguing than I realized. Or my aunt, who is a little eccentric, is like this person. Or she reminds me, all of a sudden she reminds me of Sula. And I think it just, it gave a kind of depth and dimension to the people in my everyday life. I didn't take them for granted in the same way. I gave them, I guess, a kind of backstory after reading Toni Morrison, and also seeing that people who I saw in my everyday life were the stuff of fiction. You know, they could be the stuff of fiction. And that was extraordinary too. Just like Jane Eyre could be the stuff of fiction. I'd never met a Jane Eyre. that it didn't just have to be people who I didn't know from some other place. It could be people I knew who could be this, whose lives could be on the pages of really beautiful writing.
You also incorporate in this essay characters from The Bluest Eye, Pecola Breedlove and Maureen Peel, yeah. Corintha Jean from Jean Toomer's novel, Kane.
Yeah.
But you say you return to Sula again and again because even in death, she was less defeated than either Corintha or Pecola.
Yeah, yeah. Those girls were, they felt very defeated to me, you know, as young girls, that they were defeated before they even got a chance to start. And I understood that. I understood the forces against them that defeated them. But I knew also that that was not my life. That even though, you know, I was born a dark-skinned little Black girl in a working-class neighborhood, and that there were people who had low expectations of someone born like me, that my life was not one where I was defeated before I started. And there was just something about Sula, because Sula, if people don't know the novel, she dies, but after she dies, she's still conscious, you know, she's still thinking, and she's thinking, oh, wow, I'm dead, you know, like, wait until I tell my best friend about this. And there was just something about that, that I thought, oh, boy. But I also think it was just the example of Morrison herself writing that story that just meant so much to me, that there was this group of Black women emerging who were writers. That gave me something to strive for. I was like, okay, I want to be one of them. I want to be like that.
How important is it, do you think, for young people to be able to read novels with characters that they can identify in their own communities?
You know, I don't think it's absolutely necessary, but I think it's very good. It's very important. I mean, you know, like, reading can take you out of yourself, and you can identify with people who you don't have anything in common with. I mean, you can identify with a character in a Russian novel. Reading can do that for you. Reading can make you expansive. But I think seeing yourself on the pages of a novel is really quite extraordinary. Just like seeing yourself on screen, you don't have to work so hard to imagine yourself into a character. Seeing yourself on screen is really important. I mean, it's gives you a sense of possibility that you are represented in the world. You know, you don't have to imagine yourself as something that you are not. I think that's very important.
So let's talk about your essay At Last, Michelle Obama, Beyonce, and Race, because I can recall during the Obama presidency, really the unprecedented way that Michelle Obama, the first lady, was attacked by the right.
Oh, goodness.
It was just that whole presidency. Of course, we just saw unprecedented ways that Obama was attacked,
yes,
that Michelle was attacked. And for it was almost like people were going back and trying to find things she said. And that there's, let me start with the angry Black woman issue, because there's always this trope they try to push of the angry Black woman.
Right.
And they were trying to do the same thing with Michelle Obama.
Yeah. I mean, I just have such profound admiration and respect for her. I mean, the burden that was placed on her, and she handled it with such dignity. I mean, we couldn't have asked more of her. And, you know, they pulled out every stereotype they could, the angry Black woman, the hyper militant Black woman, the, you know, like everything every racist trope they could find, they pulled out on her. And then on our side, you know, we wanted her to be perfect in every single way, not a hair out of place, like, you know, just the epitome of respectability, the, like, don't embarrass us in public, like all of those things. And I just felt like the weight of the world, and literally the weight of the world, because the eyes of the world were on her. And so I just was really every day watching, how is she handling this? And I just you know, I think that she handled it in such an extraordinary way. But that there was just a whole history that came with her, a history of a real history, a genuine history of being a Black woman in America, and then a history of all the kinds of racist stereotypes and violences that people brought with them in terms of the way they sought to bring her down.
Well, she was absolutely amazing, the way she had it with such grace and aplomb. And sometimes I think when you read these criticisms of African Americans who say things that are true about the past of America, and then you're called, you know, Mrs. Grievance.
I was like, where's the lie? Where's the lie?
Exactly.
And she never said anything that was a lie. And those of us, you know, when she said, for the first time, I'm proud of my country, I'm like, what? So like, I'm still not proud of my country. Like, you know, she got there. Like, we should be applauding the fact that she got there. I knew exactly what she was talking about.
And you bring Beyonce into it, and you have an essay in the essay. So the essay opens with Beyonce singing to the Obamas,
yes,
at the January 2009. And then you write about Beyonce building on the fantasy of the mulatto temptress, which has its origins in New World culture from Brazil to Cuba to the American South, and especially my hometown of New Orleans.
Yes, yes.
Why did you decide to bring them together in the same essay and the connection between the two?
So it was actually something that was suggested by my editor. I was going to write about Beyonce, Michelle. The idea was to write about post-racial America, right? To sort of play around with post-racial America. And so I wanted to write about Michelle because I'm fascinated with her. I've always been fascinated with her. There are actually two essays in the book about Michelle. And my editor, who is a beautiful writer himself, Gerald Early, said, why don't you write about Beyonce and Michelle? Because they are two extraordinary African-American women who have occupied a space that no Black women have occupied before. And so I thought to bring them together before they've been together in many instances since then. But when I wrote about it, it was, you know, sort of that first inauguration where Beyonce serenades them. And then I wanted to show how what are the historical narratives that they both step into, and the historical narratives on the one hand with Michelle kind of being talking about, you know, I am the descendant of slaves slaves built the White House, and now I occupy the White House. And that, you know, her enslaved great, great grandmother, which was discovered during the course of the campaign, and Beyonce having a different kind of historical narrative. And that being the historical narrative of the mixed race women of color coming out of Louisiana, that those are two historical narratives within the context of the United States that these women are the products of, and that we until we understand that, we can't really understand anything about a post-racial America, because they are sort of building upon and standing on those two histories.
And you write, Beyonce has been easier for the public to accept because mm-hmm. she is an entertainer, a long accepted role for Black women. So you're given more leeway.
Yeah.
As a Black female entertainer. Right. However, you write, Obama's acceptance is more tenuous, which is very clear. We both lived through it.
Yes.
And tenuous is a kind word to say how she was treated.
Absolutely.
And she must exercise discretion lest she expresses too firm an opinion or appear too confident. It also brings back the whole discussion of respectability politics, going back to W.E.B. Du Bois. And yes, we always got to act the right way because we want the white folks to accept us. We always got to be on our P's and Q's no matter what. They don't have to be, but right, we always have to be.
Always, always. I mean, I think what's been magnificent, this essay was written during like the first term of the Obama presidency. What's been fascinating is to watch her post the White House, you know, and the way that she's been able to be a little freer post the White House. But, you know, certainly during those years, she had to be on her P's and Q's, walking on eggshells all the time, you know, going high when they went low, over and over and over again.
Wow. So I really enjoyed your essay about teaching African-American literature during COVID-19. Yeah. And the work that your students produced when you gave them the leeway to create art,
yes,
was just amazing.
It really was. They were, you know, it was such a rough time for all of us in this country, and we were all confused. We didn't know what was happening. And my students went away for spring break, and I thought, okay, guys, see you when you get back. Not thinking that we were never going to see each other in person again, you know, and then they were far flung all over the country, all over the world. And some of them got sick and some of them had family members who were sick. And we just were like, okay, we're going to be on Zoom. Let's just recreate this classroom and do things differently. And instead of having the traditional exam, like we always do, let's create some art. Let's do something creative. And they just blew me away. I gave them that assignment, not knowing what they were going to do. I gave them several assignments, and they were just above and beyond anything I could have expected, as they always are. Young people, you know, I just find if you believe in them and you give them the structures that they need to really meet their capacity, they just always blow me away. And that's exactly what they did. I just was completely blown away by them. It was a beautiful experience and very hopeful during a very dark time.
And I was blown away by the two students who each composed, performed, and recorded original songs inspired by Octavia Butler's novel,
yes.
Parable of the Soil.
Yes.
Original songs based
original
on-
Original songs. Yes.
Wow.
Yes, original songs. I mean, who does that? And the thing is, had we been in the conventional classroom setting, that would have never happened. I would have never known they even had that capacity to do that.
And lastly, you talk about, there's a quotation from an essay, the pandemic has portal. Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew.
Yeah.
And before the pandemic, I was recording all my shows in the studio at KAZI 88.7 FM. After the pandemic, I was required to record from home,
yeah,
and set up my own home studio. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk about a break from the past, ever since, now I record from home. So talk about the students and the break from the past.
Yeah, no, it was, you know, that was the other thing. Because one of the things we talked about, I said, okay, so let's say this is true. This is a portal. We're going through it. You know, what do we want to leave behind? What do we need to leave behind? What do we want to bring forward with us? What do we want to create new? You know, and it really was a great exercise for them. And it was so interesting that what they wanted to bring forward and what they wanted to create was so interesting. They wanted to bring forward a sense of connection with other human beings, a sense of connection with their friends. What they wanted to create was things that were sustainable, ways to sustain the earth, ways to sustain community, organizations, because they saw how unequal things were, how inequitable things were. And they wanted to commit to ensuring a different world in that way. And what was so interesting, that one of the things they wanted to leave behind was being busy for the sake of being busy. So many of them said that, you know, just filling up their time with being busy. And so now I often wonder, you know, how much did we go right back into the things that we wanted to leave behind? And how much did we change? You know, I think about how they talk about employers now trying to force people back into work habits and into office spaces that folk don't want to go back into. Because they seem not to recognize that we really are living in a different world.
Well, did the COVID pandemic change how you conducted your writing, mm-hmm, and how you did your research?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, definitely how I did my research, because, you know, the archives closed down. So many of the archives that I would have gone to closed down, and things that I would have done in person, I ended up doing, fortunately, through technology, I was able to do via Zoom, you know, which created a different kind of intimacy, I think, in some ways. And I think the archival piece has been interesting, because now I've been able to get back in the archives, but the archives have responded by making things available that weren't available digitally before. So it's certainly changed. It's certainly changed the research process, very much so. Absolutely.
I want to close with a discussion about book banning and Beloved.
Yeah.
And a Virginia candidate for governor, who I believe now is governor, Glenn Youngkin, ran an ad featuring a mother who said her son, who was a high school senior at the time, suffered night terrors after reading Beloved.
Yeah.
And her books have been banned. Some of her books have been banned in many states. So I just want you to talk about the importance of reading books like Beloved.
Yeah, you know, I think we have to fight against book banning everywhere. It's the first step in an authoritarian society is to ban books. Morrison herself devoted much of her time to fighting against banning books. Her books are among the most banned in America. They make ban lists, book lists all the time. You aren't protecting children by banning books. Children, like they say, the number one cause of death amongst children are guns, not books. Children who read aren't using books to go out and harm other children. Reading helps create empathy, actually, not cause violence. And even books we don't agree with, you know, you don't ban them. You find a way to talk about them. You talk about why they're problematic. If you read a passage, certainly some books are not right for certain age groups. So you don't teach them to those age groups, but you use it as a teaching opportunity. If there's something that might give a child night terrors, especially a child who's a high school senior on his way to college, taking an AP course that's preparing him for college, he should be able to talk about in a classroom with a well-trained teacher the aspect of that book that is so disturbing. That's what classrooms are for. That's what makes learning exciting. The talk of banning a book is always dangerous and something that we should always be fighting against.
Well, Farrah Jasmine Griffin, I really enjoyed reading In Search of a Beautiful Freedom, New and Selected Essays. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me. I so enjoy talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.